I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for the invitation to speak here. I'm going to be telling you mostly about this recent project from last fall with Jan, who's a grad student at McGill, and Henry Maxfield and Eric Perlmutter. And I'll say a few words about some work in progress with Alex Maloney, Henry Maxfield, and one of Alex's students, Ioannis Siaris. However, I noticed that Alex is giving a talk in the last week, so I don't want to steal his thunder too much, so I'll try to be brief. And I should point out that this work actually started in earnest at Bootstrap 2018, so it's nice to be back. It's great to be in Canada, PI in particular. Okay, so let's get started. I don't need to tell this audience this, but I often make the point when giving this talk that in addition to giving us the tools to solve particular CFTs to really unprecedented precision, conformal bootstrap techniques have also led to enormous progress in our understanding of generic CFTs. And some of the most powerful results are in a large spin expansion where analytic methods have uncovered features of the OPE that are universal to all CFTs. Now, in two dimensions, which is the subject of this talk, you might hope that the infinite dimensional enhancement of conformal symmetry to Virasoro symmetry, plus the fact that you have really sharpened constraints of locality from modular invariants, would help you even further chart out the landscape of CFTs. But somehow, this Virasoro symmetry has been surprisingly hard to harness, especially in the chaotic or irrational regime, which is especially relevant for holography. So today, I'll talk mostly about this project, where we combine some lessons learned in the modern analytic bootstrap program with the power of infinite dimensional conformal symmetry. And the main result of this work is the complete and exact summation of all multi-stress tensor exchanges to a certain set of CFT data that is universal at large spin. And again, also when I give this talk, I often phrase it as an invitation to convince the audience that the Virasoro bootstrap program is far from a done deal, but we've already had very nice talks by Sasha and Nima that have made that point, so maybe it's not necessary. But the point is that we know very little about CFT2, let's say unitary and compact, with C bigger than 1, and irrational. What I mean by irrational is that there are infinitely many primaries with respect to whatever the highest chiral algebra is. So mostly today I'll be talking about the case where we have a twist gap in the spectrum of Virasoro primaries, which means they're irrational with respect to Virasoro, but many of the things I'll talk about can be generalized to the irrational case when you have some enhanced chiral algebra. And a stupid joke we made in this paper was that we're in desperate need of a 3D icing model for two dimensions, not to be confused with the 2D icing model, which is a completely integrable, solvable theory. So I'll start by reviewing the analytic bootstrap program in higher dimensions. This is largely unnecessary for this audience, but I'll be brief, and it serves mostly as just to emphasize the qualitative differences in two dimensions. And then I'll tell you about the main technical tool that made progress possible, this Virasoro fusion or crossing kernel. And then I'll tell you how this fusion kernel encodes information about a set of CFT data that's universal in this regime. And finally, if I have time, which is not clear, I'll say some words about holographic applications. Okay, so this audience is I'm sure, as you're well aware, an important conceptual and technical tool in the modern bootstrap is the Lorentzian OPE inversion formula of Simon Caron-Huot. And the main conceptual breakthrough, at least for the purposes of this talk, is the fact that it made manifest the fact that CFT data is analytic in spin. And this sort of formalizes an idea that's been around for a while, that CFT operators are organized into rigid analytic trajectories, which we call Reggie trajectories. And the Reggie trajectories that are dominant at large spin asymptote to these flat, evenly spaced mean field theory trajectories. And this leads to a notion of large spin universality. So here I'm plotting the twist as a function of the spin, and you can think of operators living at integer dimensions of the spin along these trajectories. And so in particular here, spin 2, twist d minus 2, every local CFT has a stress tensor. And so this is the general picture. And to see why this is the case, it's convenient to recall mean field theory or generalized free field theory. And this is a theory where correlation functions simply factorize into products of two-point functions. Let's consider some pairwise identical operator four-point function. And the statement that this is a four-point function in mean field theory is that in the T-channel, we only have exchange of the identity operator. Now, using Simone's inversion formula, or a crossing kernel, which re-expresses T-channel blocks in a basis of S-channel blocks, this can be branched into an infinite sum. Use some shorthand notation here, of so-called double twist operators. Let me call this O1, O2, and L. So let me just write this down. Double twist. And the name is a sort of cheeky play on double trace in large N theories, and the reason for that is that the dimensions are simply the scale, the engineering dimensions of the composite operator. And so you can see that the trajectories corresponding to these operators are, of course, exactly flat. And so why do I say that these trajectories are universal at large spin? Because if you imagine perturbing mean field theory, so that means in the O1 times O1 OPE, you include some other operator, then you can again branch into the cross channel, and what you see is that you get anomalous dimensions due to the exchange of O. You get corrections to OPE coefficients due to the exchange of the O, and importantly, these are suppressed at large spin. So here, the precise sense in which they're suppressed depends on the twist of the exchanged operator. But in higher dimensional CFT, there's always a twist gap above the vacuum. And so really, these are the trajectories that you're seeing at large spin. And Simone's formula sort of made that precise. And so the statement of large spin universality is that all higher D CFTs have these double twist trajectories, which approach the mean field theory values as L is taken to infinity at large spin. Are there any questions? Is this clear? Okay, and so just another comment is that these double twist trajectories are dual to towers of two particle states in ADS, which are well separated and thus non-interacting at large spin. And I should say that I'm giving a pretty ahistorical review here. Due to people in the audience, this was originally discovered by studying or solving the crossing equation in a Lorentzian kinematic regime chosen among other things so that the identity operator dominates in one channel and then it gives a singularity that has to be reproduced in the cross channel. Okay, so enough about higher dimensions. What about d equals 2? I think from a number of perspectives, it's well appreciated that two dimensions is qualitatively different. And the main reason for that is that there is no twist gap above the identity operator. In particular, you have the entire holomorphic Virasoro vacuum module, which has vanishing twist. And what this means is that this large spin expansion clearly breaks down. And it's no longer sufficient just to consider just the exchange of the identity operator in the T-channel. So it's clear that you need to work with Virasoro blocks that sum up all the exchanges of the Virasoro descendants of the identity. And this is more of a technical issue than a conceptual issue, Virasoro blocks are not known in closed form. Now, this is not always an essential obstacle. In odd dimensional CFT, we deal with this all the time. However, even in like simple Lorentzian kinematic regimes like the light cone limit, before our work and a paper that appeared concurrently by Kasuki, even that limit of the blocks were not known. And typically at finite C, they're just computed by recursion relations around the OPE limit. Okay, and just a few other words about why D equals 2 is special. In higher dimensions, stress tensor dynamics, like the TT-OPD, is not universal. It's theory dependent. And so even in the holographic context, I think at least with current technology, it's far out of reach to sum up all this multi-stress tensor or graviton exchanges to access Planckian processes in ADS quantum gravity. However, there is some interesting recent work by Fitzpatrick and Huang that studies a universal subsector at large N. This is the regime of lowest twist, but I won't say anything more about that today. And so this is all just to underscore the value of the 2D setting and in that we can actually probe these Planckian processes. Okay, so I think from this discussion, it's clear that either the inversion formula applied to individual blocks or equivalently a crossing kernel contains information about the double twist OPE data. So to study the analogs of these double twist trajectories in 2D, at the very least, we need to be able to invert Virasoro conformal blocks. And amazingly, the right tool for the job has been known in closed form for 20 years, and this is thanks to really heroic work by Ponso and Teschner. And the reason they derived it originally is because they wanted to show that Liouville theory, in particular the DOZZ formula for the structure constants, solved the crossing equation. And as I've emphasized, the Virasoro blocks aren't known, so this is hard. And so by introducing this crossing kernel, they were able to map the crossing equation onto a completeness and orthogonality relation satisfied by this crossing kernel. And that, in turn, they were able to map onto a mathematical problem, which was the Clebsch-Gordan problem for this continuous series of representations of some nasty-looking non-compact quantum group. And the crossing kernel turns out to be the 6J symbol for that group. I'm not going to say any more about that. For the purposes of this talk, that derivation is essentially black magic, and we'll be content to use this as a tool. So just to summarize, the question our work addresses is what in 2D, what do the double twist Reggie trajectories look like? And equivalently, in ADS3 quantum gravity, what is the spectrum of multi-particle bound states? And this is interesting in 3D because you don't have the same notion of liberation at large spin as you do in higher dimensions, because even at large separation, the gravitational interaction does not die off. And so there's a finite, even at infinite separation, there's a finite gravitational binding energy. And one of the main results of this work is to compute that binding energy. Are there any questions before I proceed? Okay. So I'll start just by setting up some notation. We'll focus on four-point functions of pairs of identical operators, g of z, z bar. And these four-point functions admit Virasoro conformal block decompositions. So here I'm summing over intermediate states in the S channel and introducing these holomorphic Virasoro blocks cal F. So right now these labels alpha S and alpha bar S are just proxies for the weight. I'll make that more precise in a moment. And these are the holomorphic Virasoro blocks. But we have associativity of the OPE. I'm free to also expand in the T channel. Using a different basis of Virasoro blocks, which I'll write in this way. And in 2D, it turns out it's not obvious unless you have played around with, for example, Liouville theory or the linear dilaton CFT or the Coulomb gas parameterization of the minimal models. But it turns out that there's a very natural parameterization for the CFT data. So, of course, we have the central charge, which I'll write in terms of the background charge, Q, which in turn can be expressed in terms of this Liouville coupling, B. So this is B inverse. And we'll make the choice that large C corresponds to small b. So in particular, for C bigger than 25, B is between 0 and 1. And for the other relevant case of C between 1 and 25, B is a pure phase, say in the first quadrant. Okay, as usual, I'll write the conformal dimensions and spins in terms of weights H and H bar. Delta is their sum, the spin is their difference, and the twist is just twice the minimum. So I'll often use just H or H bar as a proxy for the twist, even though there's really a factor of 2. Okay, so then it turns out to be convenient to write the conformal weights in terms of a parameter that I'll call alpha, which is the sometimes called the Liouville momentum, just because in these Liouville or linear dilaton theories, it literally is like a target space momentum. So I'll write it as H equals alpha times Q minus alpha. And note that this is invariant under reflections, alpha goes to Q minus alpha. So for unitary values of the weights, this splits up into a couple distinct regions. So for alpha between 0 and Q over 2, this corresponds to H between 0 and C minus 1 over 24, which turns out to be the BTZ threshold in the holographic regime. And I'll call this discrete, for reasons that will become clear later. The other case is I can write alpha as Q over 2 times I plus I times a real number, and this corresponds to H bigger than or equal to C minus 1 over 24. And I'll call this the continuous range. Again, for reasons that will become clear later. And just to drive home the point that this is a natural parametrization, null states of the Virasoro algebra, a primary with null state descendants has this value of alpha. So here, R and S are non-negative integers. And so a state with this value of alpha will have a null state descendant. However, for C bigger than 1, these all correspond to non-unitary values of the weights, so we're okay. Okay, if there are no questions, I'll proceed to the main technical part of the talk, which is to introduce this fusion kernel of Ponceau and Teschner. So what this thing does for a living is it decomposes T-channel blocks, for example, into a basis of S-channel blocks. So here, this is the T-channel Virasoro block. I'm integrating over the S-channel Liouville momentum, or equivalently the weight. And the decomposition is weighted by this kernel S. So here there's some contour of integration I haven't specified yet. This kernel will have poles and infinite, semi-infinite lines of poles that run to the left and run to the right in the complex alpha S plane. And the job of this contour is to go between them, separate the poles. So this is to maintain analyticity in the parameters. And so we'll see that the residues of this object S precisely encode the 2D analog of the double twist CFT data. Okay, so the kernel has some very explicit form. The precise form is really, really not essential for this talk. I just want to emphasize the amazing fact that it exists. So it also depends on the external weights, which I've taken to be pairwise identical. So these are alpha 1 and alpha 2. This is something I'll tell you about in a second. There's another contour integral here. Okay, so there, I haven't told you what I think anything in this expression means. So here SB is just a special function, which is written in terms of another special function. But this is just a generalization of the standard gamma function, but with poles at the following lattice of points and no zeros. So this function has a bunch of poles, and so this integrand has a bunch of poles, and again, they're semi-infinite, and the job of this contour is to run between them.
So what's the argument?
SBS plus UK of alpha I. So here, these are just linear combinations of the various alphas in the game. Same for here, but same down here, this is VK, that's just some different linear combinations. And here, this is just a ratio of products of gamma B functions. So the whole point here is just that this thing has a bunch of poles in alpha S, in the alpha S plane. What is important for our purposes is the analytic structure in the alpha S plane. And the main point is that this kernel S of alpha S and alpha T has double poles at the following values of alpha S. Again, M and N are non-negative integers here. So at this value, at Q minus this value, and six permutations under reflections, so alpha goes to Q minus alpha, of the individual weights. And so what that means is it has semi-infinite lines of double poles, and the only important exception to this is the case that you have exchange of the vacuum, the identity Verma module in the T-channel, in which case these are only simple poles. So there are two qualitatively different cases, depending on the values of the external weights. The first I'll call heavy. This is the case where the sum of the alphas is in the continuous range. And so in this case, so here is the line, this is the alpha S plane, this is Q over 2. In this case, all the poles are well separated from the contour, or from the continuous series, this line at Q over 2. And your contour can simply be taken to run along this continuous range. And what that means is that the T-channel block has support only on the continuum. So this is evaluated at alpha s is equal to q over 2 plus ip. So a T-channel block with external operators in this range has support only on the continuum range with h bigger than c minus 1 over 24 in the cross channel. Now, in the other region, so I call this light. This is when alpha 1 plus alpha 2 sum to something less than q over 2. So this means that the sum is in the discrete range. In this case, something qualitatively different happens. So again, this is the alpha S plane. This is the line real part alpha S equals q over 2. What happens is some of these poles cross the contour. And to maintain analyticity, what that means is that we have to pick up the residues of these poles. And so, in addition to the continuum, you have a finite number of discrete residue contributions. Depending on how many of these poles cross the contour. I'm calling this alpha m. It's labeled by a non-negative integer m. And it's simply alpha 1 plus alpha 2 plus mb. And it's whenever this thing is less than q over 2, you get a pole that crosses the contour. And so what that means is that the T-channel decomposition, I won't write the full thing, but it includes this finite sum. Let me call the largest value of m such that this is true, m star, of residue contributions. Plus continuum, as before. Are there any questions about all this? I realize it's rather technical. Okay, so this is where the distinction between the vacuum and the non-vacuum kernels become important, because the non-vacuum kernels have double poles, and so inside this residue, you'll pick up a derivative with respect to the block. And so when we proceed, the residues of the vacuum kernel will serve as the analogs of the double twist OPE data, whereas the coefficient of the double pole will have the interpretation of an anomalous dimension, like the first term in a Taylor series. And the residue of the non-vacuum kernel will be like corrections to the double twist OPE data. And this decomposition makes it completely straightforward to write down the cross-channel limit of the blocks, because depending on which range you're in, either heavy or light, the say we're looking at the T-channel block and the limit z goes to 0. In that case, the dominant contribution either comes from the lightest double twist guy or the bottom of the continuum, where you can do a saddle point calculation. And this was actually confirmed in previous numerical work by Kasuki and Takayanagi, where they found a phase transition in the behavior of the blocks depending on how heavy the external operators were. Okay, so this leads us to introduce something with a silly name, a Virasoro mean field theory. What do I mean by that? Well, in every compact 2D CFT, the vacuum Verma module, so the identity in all of its Virasoro descendants, contributes to the T-channel expansion of the four-point function. And so this leads us to introduce Virasoro mean field theory to simply be the cross-channel OPE data that you get from inverting the T-channel Virasoro vacuum block. So this is the vacuum block times its right-moving partner in the T-channel. And of course, using this technology, we can branch this into the cross-channel. D alpha S, D alpha S bar. Okay, so then you see it's pretty clear that these vacuum kernels serve as a spectral density for the OPE coefficients in this cross-channel decomposition. And we'll see that the non-vacuum kernels encode corrections to this VMFT OPE data. And so, of course, so far this seems very formal and ad hoc. There's no reason to believe it's universal yet. But we'll see that, nevertheless, it does define a universal set of CFT data. Okay, so it should be clear then that the spectrum of this funny-sounding VMFT is nothing but the support of the cross-channel decomposition of the vacuum block. And so this is what really leads to the qualitative departure from the evenly spaced discrete trajectories that you get in higher dimensions. So this I'm plotting here h and h bar. Here's c minus 1 over 24. So there are a finite number of discrete double twists, and then you hit the continuum at the black hole threshold. And so there are these sort of three different regions, discrete times discrete, discrete times continuous, and continuous by continuous. And the only part that will be universal will be at the extreme. So either the large H part of the discrete times continuum or in the continuum times continuum. This part here will never be universal. And as a function of the central charge, the picture to draw is the following. This is C, this is H, here's C minus 1 over 24. The picture is that for fixed C, so for any given theory, you have a finite number of discrete trajectories, and then you run into the continuum at the black hole threshold. Is the picture clear? Sure. So when at least one of the weights is in this discrete range, you can define the Virasoro analogs of these double twist operators. So we denote these with curly brackets just to distinguish from the standard double twists in higher dimensions. They're labeled by a non-negative integer m as before and the spin L. So these have alpha equals alpha m less than q over 2. And the weight is the following. So there's the standard engineering sum that you would expect from mean field theory in higher dimensions. But there's a universal anomalous dimension, and one of the main results of this paper is to compute this anomalous dimension. And so what's amazing is that it's extremely simple. It takes an extremely simple form as long as you're using the right variables. And it's always negative. So I want to emphasize that this formula is exact in both the central charge and the weights, and it represents the complete contribution of all multi-stress tensor exchanges to the double twist anomalous dimension. And so this simple change of basis from C and H to alpha and B captures all the nonlinearities. So as long as you're using the right variables, the formula is extremely simple. Yeah. Good. This is in the discrete range. So, h, let's say h bar is taking one of these values, and h is just h bar plus l. So h is very large, but h bar is taking one of these discrete values. Yeah. So it's remarkable that such a simple formula exists. But this is one of the luxuries one has in two dimensions. So just to summarize. Some of the peculiar features of this VMFT. You have a continuum when the twist is above C minus 1 over 12, or H bigger than C minus 1 over 24. At finite C, the discrete part of the spectrum truncates. And for sufficiently heavy external operators, the discrete part isn't even there to begin with. So that's a big qualitative departure from higher dimensions. Even in the discrete sector, the spins are generically non-integral. But that's OK, because that part will never give a dominant contribution to a large spin. And it has the funny feature that it's additive in this parameter alpha, the Liouville momentum. And so now, the statement of large spin universality, which I'll substantiate in a moment, is the following. The statement is that in all, where all means unitary, compact, C bigger than one, and a gap in the spectrum of twists. So I say all, however, I don't think we know a single example of such a CFT, but this last assumption, the gap in the twist, in the spectrum of twists, can be relaxed. It's not essential. We just need to generalize our techniques to account for the higher chiral algebra. What's really essential here is that I'm talking about irrational CFT. So in all such CFT2, the OPE data approaches VMFT at large spin. And so in particular, for any two Virasoro primaries that are sufficiently light, you have these towers of discrete trajectories, and you also have a continuum in twist as long as the spin is large. And corrections to this VMFT simply come from the inversion of other T-channel operators, which must be present in the spectrum anyway. However, those corrections are subleading in large spin, as I'll describe in a moment.
Do we know that VMFT is cross-symmetric?
It's not. Unlike mean field theory, it's not. And that's reflected in these numerous pathologies. And so it's clear that you're missing something. And one question is, what is the minimal completion? Like, what do you need to add to the vacuum in the T-channel? And at the very least, it's clear that you have T-channel double twists. So a natural conjecture is that you need only supplement the vacuum with the T-channel double twists to get something well-behaved. But that hasn't been shown either. OK, so why do I say this? So let's look at the regime of large spin. I'm going to parameterize this by taking h bar large. So I'll write this as alpha s bar to be q over 2 plus I p bar, with p bar going to infinity. So here, the s channel spin in the regime of large spin is roughly p bar squared. Then, to examine the contributions of non-vacuum operators as we did in standard mean field theory, or corrections to mean field theory, we can examine the following ratio. So consider the contribution of some finite twist T-channel operator compared to that of the vacuum. And what you find this is in the limit that p bar is going to infinity, that in fact corrections are exponentially suppressed in the square root of the spin. And compared to our intuition from mean field theory, that's actually much faster than we had any right to expect. And so this was a surprise a priori. So this is essentially the reason that this CFT data is universal at large spin. So to see this concretely, let's look at some of these discrete large spin trajectories. You could also look at the continuum, but I find it instructive to look at these discrete trajectories at large spin. So in this case, the correlator will include this finite number of discrete trajectories from the inversion of the vacuum. So there's this finite sum, m equals 0 to m star. There's some OPE spectral density. And there are the blocks. So here we have alpha s equals alpha m on the left, and just in the continuum range on the right. And this this OPE spectral density is given explicitly by the following formula. Simply comes from the residue of at alpha s equals the double twist value, alpha m, of the vacuum kernel. And this is evaluated, I guess, at alpha s bar equals q over 2 plus I p. And now, to derive corrections to this, you include other operators in the t-channel. And we'll see that that leads to anomalous dimensions and corrections to OPE coefficients. So in particular, you'll have an anomalous Liouville momentum, if you want, due to the exchange of some t-channel operator. And this is given by t-channel OPE coefficients. Following residue. This is again at alpha s equals alpha n. And again evaluated at alpha s bar equals q over 2 plus I p bar. And similarly, you can derive corrections to the OPE spectral density. And these come simply from the residue of the non-vacuum kernel. And the main point is that both of these corrections at large spin are exponentially suppressed. There's a similar analysis with the continuum where instead of having these residues, you just have the product of kernels themselves. And so the point is that, this isn't delta rho m0, delta rho m due to the t-channel operator. And so the point is that delta alpha m and delta rho m are all exponentially suppressed at p bar goes to infinity, so large spin. And so as long as there's a gap in the spectrum of twists, this CFT data is universal. Are there any questions? Right. Well, at large spin, this effect is invisible. The fact that the spectrum of twists is continuous is not a problem because the spin is infinite. At finite spin, yes, it will require the inversion of infinitely many operators to render the spectrum discrete and supported only on integer spins. Not really, because we don't have any examples to play with. At finite spin, no, definitely not. At finite spin, definitely not. It's analogous to higher dimensions in that sense. And that's good because we need this, the t-channel spectrum to have, you know, to be discrete and supported on integer spins. Yeah?
So you consider the corrections due to some operator.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually matter. There is an upper bound on the twist gap of C minus 1 over 12, so yes, I guess there is always an operator in the discrete range, but there are also infinitely many operators in the continuous range. So I'm considering the correction due to any fixed t-channel operator. It doesn't matter whether it's in the continuum or the discrete range. Okay, so now I'm going to say a few words about this upcoming work with Alex, Henry, and Ioannis. So this VMFT CFT data is universal at large spin because of the suppression of contributions of positive twist operators in the t-channel. And in fact, the same argument applies to the large dimension limit, essentially because of holomorphic factorization in 2D. And so I guess I've already said this, but we can then interpret the fusion kernel as an asymptotic microcanonical density of OPE coefficients once we divide by the asymptotic density of primary states, i.e. Cardy's formula. So it's convenient and I think instructive to revisit the derivation of Cardy's formula. As Sasha reviewed yesterday, there are arbitrarily many derivations with lacking levels of rigor. I'll contribute to that. I'll add one more. But it's in the same spirit as what I've told you about so far. So Sasha and Nima have already introduced the language of torus partition functions and Virasoro characters, so I can assume you already know about those. Consider the following object called the modular S matrix, which is essentially the torus partition function analog of this crossing kernel. And what it does is it writes characters in one frame in a basis of characters in the modular S transform frame. I'm going to call this S mod prime alpha chi alpha minus 1 over tau. I should call this P prime. And this is alpha prime equals Q over 2 plus I. So here there are no subtleties with poles. This thing is, in fact, just a Fourier transform in this parameter P. And so there, it only has support in the continuous range. And so similarly to the arguments I presented so far, the large dimension asymptotics of the vacuum modular S matrix, so where you have the vacuum in one channel, will then define a universal density of states at large dimension, namely Cardy's formula. So let's look at this. Let's look at the chiral half, essentially, of Cardy's formula. I'm going to define this quantity rho zero of alpha to be the modular S matrix corresponding to inversion of the identity character. And this is not simply a Fourier transform just because of the identity character is degenerate, as Nima reviewed. Yeah, thank you. Definitely. So I'm going to define this density to be that you get from inverting the vacuum character. And this has some simple closed form in terms of these B and alpha parameters. So here I'm using P and alpha interchangeably, just with alpha equal to Q over 2 plus IP. So P could be imaginary here. Yeah. It's really from 0. It could be minus infinity because if you want, you could half the. It's supported on weights bigger than or equal to C minus 1 over 24, so P is real and between 0 and infinity. It could be minus infinity if you want, because the weights are invariant under reflection. And the point is that the large weight asymptotics of this thing, so I take P to infinity, I get the following simple exponential. Which may not look familiar in its current form, but really it's just Cardy's formula in disguise. And so this is similarly universal. In fact, this has only recently been emphasized under the name of the extended Cardy's formula, meaning that there's a version of Cardy's formula valid at large spin as well as large dimension. It simply comes from the inversion of the identity character, and it's universal because, essentially for the same reasons as VMFT or mean field theory, because the contributions of non-vacuum operators are suppressed exponentially again. And in fact, this is part of a whole cottage industry in the 2D, in the CFT bootstrap, especially in two dimensions, where one studies the crossing equation in a particular kinematic regime where the exchange of the identity dominates in one channel, and then what you do is you branch that to the cross channel and infer universal asymptotics about the spectrum or the dynamics. And canonical examples of this are Cardy's formula, the light cone bootstrap, as I've reviewed it, and yeah, there's a whole litany in the literature of asymptotic formulas for OPE coefficients, heavy, light, light, heavy, heavy, light, heavy, 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 coming from studying various crossing equations. And one of the main results of this work is to show that all of those asymptotic formulas have a single origin. Okay, so I'm going to pictorially review how this derivation goes. Again, I don't want to steal too much thunder from Alex, but let's review. So I've already essentially given the derivation of the heavy light light OPE asymptotics. So consider a sphere four-point function. Maybe I'll draw it with like pairs of pants instead of punctures. This is the T channel. You have 01, 01, 02, 02. So imagine you have the identity in one channel. Branch this into the cross channel. times so this is 01, 02, 102, and now you have some guy and some intermediate guy OS. Maybe I should use a different color. That says OS. And the point is that this kernel here can be written as this universal asymptotic density rho zero, which is related to Cardy's formula, or the inversion of the vacuum character, times some remainder. And this remainder, C zero, so once you average, you essentially divide by the asymptotic density of this heavy guy. This gives the product of left and right gives the universal formula for heavy, light, light OPE coefficients. And this is essentially the statement that the continuum density is universal at large spin or equivalent, or also large dimension in the continuous range. Is the strategy clear? Okay. Now, to study more general crossing equations, we use a Mohr Seiberg gluing construction to construct a higher genus crossing kernels. And a basic result of the Mohr Seiberg construction is that all of these crossing kernels, which implement changes in pair of pants decompositions of Riemann surfaces, can be built out of two elementary ingredients, namely this sphere 4-point crossing kernel and a torus 1-point kernel, which implements the modular S transform. So to probe heavy, heavy light, let's look at the torus 2-point function. I'll draw it like this, with this pair of pants decomposition. So to use stick diagrams, just to make the logic more clear, so you have two external operators, O, which I'll take to be identical, and consider the exchange of the identity in this OPE channel. Then I can branch this again using these Mohr Seiberg kernels in the cross channel. So this is some new torus 2-point object whose derivation I won't review. They just know that we can compute it. This expresses the block in this channel in a sum over blocks in an alternate pair of pants decomposition. So now I cut along this cycle and along this cycle, and I have internal operators O1 and O2 here. So this just means this block, but with these weights propagating in these channels. And the surprising thing is that this object takes a remarkably simple form and very similar to the one we wrote down earlier. So then once I average over the heavy operators O1 and O2, I again recover this universal formula C0. Finally, to probe heavy, heavy, heavy OPE asymptotics, we can look at the genus 2 partition function. So let's consider these genus 2 characters in what I'll call the dumbbell channel. Oh, by the way, this stick figure here is sometimes called the necklace channel, which is more clear if you look at it drawn as sticks instead of the pair of pants decomposition. Okay, so then again, we consider this cutting with the identity inserted along all these internal channels. You probably see where this is going. 2 alpha 3. Three identities in the T channel. of these blocks in a different pair of pants decomposition. So now I cut the Riemann surface like this, and like this, with O1, O2, and O3 propagating in these internal channels. And again, the surprising thing is that this takes a remarkably simple form, rho 0 alpha 1, rho 0 alpha 2, rho 0 alpha 3, times C0 alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3. So again, it's the same formula that is governing the asymptotics of heavy, 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 light, and heavy, light, light OPE coefficients appropriately averaged over the heavy operator. And the reason this result is universal is, again, because non-vacuum contributions over here are exponentially suppressed. So as long as you take the internal weights large, this guy, the vacuum will always win out. And the final surprise is that this object C0 is essentially the DOZZ formula for the structure constants in Liouville theory. So there's a sense in which Liouville theory governs the dynamics of heavy operators in irrational 2D CFT, despite the fact that Liouville neither has a vacuum nor has spinning primaries. But yeah, this is the chiral half of the DOZZ formula, so it's okay. Yeah, Nima. So this is how these equations were originally derived. Normally, like in a large C limit, but like normally what you do is you take some kinematic limit to project onto the dominance of the identity. But here, I'm arguing directly from the perspective that these kernels serve as densities. And then as long as the heavy guys have weights taken to be large, then anything else you have in the T-channel won't matter. It will be subleading. Well, the statement is that the identity in one channel universally governs the asymptotics of heavy operators in the other channel. This is like Hardy's formula or like cone bootstrap. So is the general strategy clear? I was really quick here, but I'll let Alex tell the rest of the story. Okay, so I have, I guess, minus 2 minutes. Let me just say a few very sketchy words about the holographic interpretation. So I said earlier that one can interpret mean field theory as the dual of free fields on an ADS background. And so absent interactions, the energies of composite states simply add. And so this is universal at large spin because the gravitational interaction dies off at large angular separation in the bulk corresponding to large orbital angular momentum. And so in defining this VMFT, we've incorporated all multi-stress tensor exchanges, which in the bulk corresponds to taking into account the complete contribution of gravitons to these multi-particle binding energies. And it has the remarkably simple effect that the Liouville momentum alpha becomes an additive quantity. So there are these funny things, discrete trajectories. We thought of as multi-particle states. In ADS3, which now have non-trivial binding energy even at infinite spin or infinite separation in the bulk. And these only exist for sum over I alpha I less than Q over 2. And this corresponds to black hole formation. And then the continuum at twist bigger than C minus 1 over 12 just corresponds to spinning BTZ black holes. And so above the BTZ threshold, this VMFT theory becomes continuous and only captures some coarse-grained aspects of the physics. And of course, you know, we expect that resolving the discrete spectrum of microstates is not going to happen for free. We're going to have to know we're going to have some knowledge of the UV degrees of freedom to get a discrete spectrum of microstates. So I don't think anything is inconsistent here. So finally, I'll just end by saying that this additivity of the Liouville momentum has a sort of elegant geometrical interpretation in the bulk. So consider the semi-classical regime. which I'll parameterize by taking C to infinity with the weight scaling with the central charge. So HI over C fixed. In this case, O1 and O2 are dual to heavy particles that back react on the geometry and source conical defects, conical defect geometries. With the following deficit angle, so the important point is that it's linear in the alpha i's. So this spectrum of discrete twists is such that the corresponding deficit angles of your apartheid states simply add. So here's ADS3. Suppose this is delta phi 1. This is delta phi 2. These are the conical defects or conical deficit angles sourced by the back reaction of the particles dual to O1 and O2 respectively. Then their sum is the conical the deficit angle sourced by the double twist composite. And this additivity rule the fact that the sum of the alphas has to be less than Q over 2 just means that the total deficit angle has to be less than or equal to, or less than 2 pi, at which point you form a BTZ black hole. And in fact, there's a nice gravitational interpretation of the distinction between the, remember I told you that the corrections to VMFT scale exponentially at large spin. In higher dimensions, this decay due to non-vacuum exchange reflects the exponential falloff of the interaction mediated by some bulk field dual to the internal operator. And in fact, in two dimensions, the exact same explanation works. There's just a subtle gravitational screening effect due to the fact that you have to consider Virasoro primaries in the bulk. Okay, so I'll conclude just by advertising some other applications. We gave a new derivation of the heavy light Virasoro blocks, originally derived by Fitzpatrick, Kaplan, and Walters. It sort of made manifest what was going on with the forbidden singularities. If you want to know more, let's chat after. And gave a systematic way to compute 1 over C corrections. And we also gave a derivation of the Lorentzian light time limit of the Virasoro block. They have these polynomial decay at late Lorentzian time. This was first observed in a sort of tour de force, a numerical computation by Dalyang, Hongbin, and others. I anticipate a lot of future applications of this technology. Thanks. I'm done.
You told us about this sort of double twist apparatus. What about multi-twist? You have more than two.
Yeah, I think you can imagine iterating the procedure where you consider an external operator to be a double twist, and then you get some triple twist in the intermediate. You can imagine continuing to iterate that higher and higher. And of course, the statistics become more complicated as you go to higher multi-twists. But
the gap sort of on the maximal twist still stays.
It still saturates at C minus 1 over 12 for essentially the same reason.
So eventually, there is a gap on the number of multi-twists, because if I take the minimal twist, then...
Exactly. Yeah, but that's also a complete qualitative difference from higher dimensions. It will depend on the dimension of the operator you're building composites out of. There's a nice recent application of this idea in a paper by Henry where he looked at, he imagined summing up the multi-twist operators in modular bootstrap and derived a shift in the BTZ threshold at large spin. There's a spin-dependent shift in the BTZ threshold that comes from summing up all these multi-twist operators.
So does this nice additivity still hold above the BTZ threshold also? I mean, it won't have the interpretation.
Yeah, above BTZ, it doesn't even make sense because you, yeah, once the sum is bigger than Q over 2, anything goes and you create a black hole.
So what would be the double twist if I take two BTZ of black holes? It'll just make one with the mass as the sum?
Yeah, you just get some...
include the identity?
And that, at large spin, the spectrum is continuous. Of course, what happens at the discrete level is more open, but yeah. We're not really able to probe that question here.
So you wouldn't give the interpretation of these diagrams that you're drawing as quantum corrections to pure gravity anomalous?
Quantum corrections to pure gravity.
No, you're doing one loop calculations in gravity.
Well, here I need matter to build these multi-twist operators.
Right, but you're only including the graviton exchange.
Yeah, that's right.
So what about these discrete labels, the spin and these integers that you all, what's the holographic meaning of these discrete labels in this picture of conical deficits?
Oh, yeah. So strictly speaking, I'm working at large spin here. Spin is, because this additivity rule really only holds at large spin. Like all the, everything, essentially everything I did required large spin. And so this picture really only makes sense when the bulk fields have some large orbital angular momentum.
Can you say a bit more words about the holographic interpretation that the corrections are exponentially suppressed in the spin?
So in higher dimensions, you superpose two highly boosted particles, and you know they acquire some large orbital angular momentum. And essentially, the distinction in 2D is that our result for the exponential falloff of the anomalous dimension, that was working at fixed central charge, taking the spin to infinity. And it turns out that in this limit, the relationship between the orbital angular momentum of the bulk operator and the S-channel spin of the exchanged operator is modified. And it's modified essentially because you have to be considering the dual of a Virasoro primary. And this is important when the spin is much larger than the central charge. So in fact, we considered a regime of Planckian spin, which was C to infinity, but L, the spin scaling with C. And we derived some different formula for the corrections to the anomalous dimensions. And depending if L over C was much bigger than one, then you get our result. And if L over C was much smaller than one, then you get the old light cone bootstrap result, the L to the minus tau. So there's some formula that cleanly interpolates between the two. And in fact, we did a bulk calculation to reproduce that.
Can you comment on what is the set of ingredients that you have to add to resolve these issues with continuum and non-integral?
Yeah, that's a great question that we don't know the full answer to. It's clear that, at least from the bulk perspective, you know, the Witten diagrams will include T-channel double traces, for example. So it's clear that at the very least we're missing that, the multi-twists in the T-channel, but it's not clear whether that's sufficient to resolve the spectrum into something sensible. The answer is we don't know.
Okay, well, thanks, Scott.